Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
In this program, we are looking into a powerful collusion between government regulators and the fossil fuel industry, how it hides the real dangers of fracking for natural gas. Theo Colburn continues with more unreported air pollution dangers in this teleconference for the nonprofit citizens group Great Lakes United in January 2012.
The second source of chemicals is the VOCs from combustion of diesel and other fuels to maintain mobile and stationary equipment during operations. They are in the exhaust stream that is released in large volumes 24/7 throughout both drilling and fracking operations. Many of the wells drilled in Colorado within the past decade took as much as a month to complete. Today, using new sophisticated rigs and diamond drill bits, but don't expect to have these in your neighborhood, a drill event may still take as long as a week or more. To back this equipment up, there will be many huge tanker trucks coming and going to the pad, carrying a constant supply of both diesel fuel and water. They sit in long lines, idling their motors, waiting their turn to unload. In addition, many auxiliary service pickup trucks move in and out of the pad throughout the day and night. To their exhaust is added the exhaust from huge generators and compressors that burn diesel to maintain pressure throughout all the operations. And added to all that is the flaring or burning off of the natural gas that decays from the ground the minute the drill bore hits gas in the target stratum. That is a pad where drilling and fracking is finished. Well, okay, that pad is finished. Now they're apparently waiting to hook up to the local delivery line and bring the well to completion. But all during that time, they let the gas escape by flaring. Flaring may go on for months. We have a well near us that has been waiting for a year that has been flaring. The flaring exacerbates exposure by contributing fine particulate matter to the air that for many individuals causes irritation and respiratory problems. And I know one man who has convulsions if he gets downwind from a flare. And yet another overlooked source of exposure is hydrogen sulfide in areas where there are sulfides in the soil and where chemicals in open pits can react and produce it. Hydrogen sulfide has a rotten egg smell, but it is harmful long before you can smell it. It has been a bane to welders on oil and gas pads for years. Most of them now wear wrist monitors to detect it. But the most overlooked chemicals the workforce and neighbors will come in contact with are the native VOCs that come to the surface in the natural gas along with the methane. Methane, the largest volatile component in natural gas at about 85% or more, is not toxic, but many of the other gases that escape from the ground with the methane come with their own set of health problems. They can escape at every juncture, from equipment on the pad, like the Christmas trees where the gas comes up from the ground, especially from heater treaters, where gases and oils are separated from the fluids that come up with the gas, and at every other piece of stationary equipment, like compressors, and then pigging stations all along the pipelines. Despite all of the above, neither the federal government nor industry is doing much monitoring of the air environment around natural gas activity. The good news is that some citizens have managed to get the money to take some infrared pictures that reveal the fugitive gases leaking from all kinds of stationary equipment on and off the pad. And better yet, local citizens have started what is called the Bucket Brigade, in which they do their own sampling, and even some counties are doing some cross-sectional sampling. So here we provide just a partial list of the health effects of those chemicals that have 11 health effects out of a possible 12. A large percent interfere with the brain and the endocrine system, which operates at extremely low concentrations. You know from the work around the Great Lakes, endocrine-disrupting chemicals can have devastating impacts on wildlife and humans. For most of these chemicals, there are no government safety standards to identify at what level exposure leads to harm. And for those where a safety standard may have been established, the standard was based on an 8-hour workday, 5 days a week, for a 70-kilogram man working in a confined area. None of those standards took into consideration effects on the endocrine system and the consequences of prenatal exposure. So let's take a look at the jobs that are going to be available for people who like to work outside. Other than a handful of salaried managers working directly for the large corporations, the bulk of the labor force needed to get the gas into commerce works on contracts, subcontracts, and sub-subcontracts. We have even run into a situation where someone was hired through a temp agency as a sub-sub-subcontractor and without proper training went to work and in less than 3 hours ended up in the hospital emergency room. We have verified with many contract employees that they had to sign a contract in which they agreed never to reveal their hourly wage or talk about their health and must never call 911 if they became ill or involved in an accident. If they do, they will be fired. They are given a company phone number to call instead. They get no health insurance, and Social Security and income tax are not taken out of their pay. So, I have talked with men after they became too ill to work and have had trouble getting any kind of compensation. They admit from the first week on the job, they experienced a suite of symptoms similar to those that many residents have complained about when drilling starts in their neighborhood, from headaches, burning eyes and skin, coughing, flu-like symptoms, asthma, and insomnia. And they also discover they have hypertension and other systemic problems, which like anyone could experience as he or she ages. But there is no way for clinicians to relate those symptoms with chemical exposure. For many laborers and residents, the nervous system symptoms are the same. So many experiencing peripheral neuropathy, numbness and tingling in their hands and feet, and plagued with totally unpredictable pain, fibromyalgia, and swelling in their arms, feet and legs, and outright multiple chemical sensitivity. It is when the men and women begin to develop tremors, memory loss, and experience convulsions, symptoms of MCS, and deep depression, so that they cannot work anymore and turn to workman's compensation. They find out that they cannot collect because they have nothing to prove they were exposed to something. Whether a resident or a natural gas industry contract worker, they have nowhere to turn to be compensated for their misery and loss of income that essentially started when the drilling started. Homeowners find themselves in a bind. Too ill to stay where they are. Look at the people living down in this house here to the left. They have no money to move somewhere else to rent because they still have a mortgage on the house that they can't sell. And most of those that I have met are fighting terrible insecurity and depression. It is a tragedy that EPA was told it could not look into air pollution in its upcoming report on fracking. This was a serious omission on the part of the government. And it's true that water contamination poses serious concerns to potable and agricultural water wherever natural gas drilling and reinjection is occurring. But while water contamination is a possibility, you can be sure that air contamination is a certainty.
That was Theo Colburn of TEDx, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange at endocrinedisruption.com. She was speaking in a press conference for the nonprofit citizens group Great Lakes United on January 10, 2012. Shortly after this program, you can download a recording of the whole teleconference from the energy section at our website, ecoshock.org. I recommend it. You will hear so many people sick and worried sick about fracking. At the start of this program, we delved into the House hearing on an EPA study. I was distressed to see the weak presentation by the EPA regional administrator. It turns out the EPA itself, even as it is hobbled by industry and the White House, is also weakened by a long regime of disturbing behavior inside. It's an honor to talk with Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo, who has been through it all.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Maybe you suspect the white male establishment doesn't care about the health of women and minorities. And we do hear little stories about lives disabled and lost overseas making our consumer products. But what happens if you know for sure it's true and you speak out? Our guest is Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo. She is a fearless whistleblower at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. She sued the government for sexual and racial discrimination and won, and then she stimulated a new law called the No Fear Act. Now Dr. Coleman Adebayo is founder of the No Fear Coalition. Marcia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
I do admit, right off the bat, I totally underestimated the huge issues you raise in your book, No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph. It's more than a personal story of bravery, and it's not just about America. What did you find at the EPA?
I think that this deals with the way the United States government looks at people inside the government that decide to reject the code of silence. This is what I, in my book, I talk about green crimes. You know, we know a lot about white-collar crimes, and we know that when police officers protect themselves, we call that sort of a blue crime. But what about green crimes? And so my book sort of explores green crimes on both sides of the Atlantic, both in the United States government, inside the federal government itself, as well as in Africa. And in the United States government, whether you're a man or whether you're a woman, if you point out, if you begin to sound the alarm about corruption, at that point, the government considers you an enemy of the state. And once you are targeted, or once you are considered an enemy of the state, you know, the gloves come off and you are treated as a combatant, which means that they go after you with everything that they have in their arsenal. And, you know, we're talking about the most powerful, the wealthiest, the most violent, you know, nation on earth. And so when all of that force is arrayed against an individual, it becomes overwhelming. So that's one part of it. It's the enemy of the state part on the United States side. Overseas, you know, it's a question of money, quite frankly. Their resources, the United States government, security issues or needs that the government has. And if countries happen to possess those strategic minerals, like in South Africa or Iraq, then the country, the United States government, starts to provide the kinds of force it needs to extract those resources. In my situation, I was at the United States Environmental Protection Agency. I found out about a U.S. multinational corporation that was exploiting, and in fact, the reports that I received was that people were dying and becoming injured. And when I reported it and I refused to stop talking about it, then all that force was basically targeted towards me. And that's sort of where my story starts.
And that was the case of vanadium, a metal that's used to stop metal from cracking when it reheats too many times. And that was easily solved, perhaps, with some basic health protection for foreign workers. And it's not an isolated case. We have the Bhopal disaster in India, and just lately, these Chinese workers dying from dangerous conditions making parts for Apple. What should legislators be doing to ensure we aren't killing people who make the products we all buy?
Right. Well, yeah, vanadium is used as an alloy in steel, and so it helps the steel contract and expand. And so it's important for your listeners to know what vanadium is used in, because we are all the beneficiaries of the hard work of vanadium workers. Vanadium is used in forks and spoons and cars and trucks and refrigerators and planes. Anytime steel is exposed to hot and cold conditions, most likely it has vanadium in it. So vanadium is a part of our everyday lives that we don't even notice that we use steel, because steel is such an important, it undergirds our society. It is the sacrifice of the South African vanadium workers which allows us to live, to kind of have the kind of lifestyle we have in this country. And more importantly, I should say, in terms of my theme again of green crimes, is that the vanadium or steel is a very important part of green technology in terms of windmills or, you know, invective roofs or solar panels. Vanadium, steel is a part of all those new green technologies. So even our green technologies are based upon the exploitation of South African vanadium mine workers. And so what I tried to do was something very basic, and that was I successfully was able to usher through a resolution through the committee that I work for, which is the Gore and Becky Committee. And that is that two vice presidents came together, the vice president from South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, who eventually became the president of South Africa, and Al Gore. And so I was the head of the Environment Committee under the Gore and Becky Committee. And so what I did was I ushered in a resolution that would allow that in which the United States government and South Africa agreed to allow an independent team of scientists to go to South Africa and to investigate whether or not these workers were actually dying from vanadium poisoning. Obviously, that's the first step in making a decision as to how we proceed. And that report was stymied. It was crushed.
Well, our guest is MIT-trained Dr. Coleman Adebayo, the whistleblower who sued the EPA and won. And Marcia, the racial bias of pollution isn't just overseas. I interviewed people from WE Act, a group in Harlem. They complained that whenever there was a need for a new waste dump or a polluting bus yard, it all went to Harlem. What would you say about the persistent pollution of African Americans and the price they pay in their health?
Well, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. I think that the ratio is that like 60% of all African American kids have neurotoxic levels of lead in their brains, which, as you know, causes all kinds of learning disabilities and motor problems. During the last, you know, Gulf oil spill, Lisa Jackson, the African American head of the EPA, signed off on BP dumping, sort of overlooking a white community that was the next on the list for receiving waste, and they basically skipped over that community and dumped the waste from BP in a black community. They allowed primarily black prisoners to clean up and to be exposed to petroleum waste from BP. But this is not an isolated incident. I mean, this is just the way the United States government has operated when it comes to what they consider disposable communities. And the African-American community, to a large extent, has been considered disposable. So it's something that we have to constantly fight against. And even the community in South Africa, which is also a community, you know, which I think those in power would consider disposable because the people make very little money. There's a very large pool of unemployed people to take the place of those who are being injured and dying in South Africa. And so they just go in, they injure, they harm the workers, and then essentially they find new workers to take their place.
And there are some good people in government in the United States who try to right these wrongs, and they pay a big price. What happens to whistleblowers?
Well, to a large extent, you know, there are two things that happen. One is that we have the incredible opportunity of living out, you know, a very important basis of who we are as human beings, and that is telling the truth, doing the right thing, trying to save lives. That I'm not really sure how you put a monetary value on that. On the other hand, the state does what it does best, and that is that when it finds a foreign body inside of a system that they consider dangerous to the larger system, all the forces of that system moves fairly quickly to eliminate that foreign body. The foreign body that I'm talking about right now are whistleblowers. And so the federal government acts as any system does, you know, whether it's a physical system of your body and it's trying to counteract the cold or flu and all the various parts of the body sort of move to attack that virus and to eject it so that the body can be healthy. In the federal government, you have a very similar system where, you know, you have a system that sort of is where corruption is embedded as a part of the basic operating function of the system because you're dealing with a system that protects corporations and protects what we call in the Occupy movement the 1%, so that when you have what that system considers almost like a foreign body embedded in the system, almost all the different parts of the system move to eject that foreign body, and those are whistleblowers or truth tellers. And so what's interesting about your question is that most people, when they blow the whistle, don't even know that they're blowing the whistle. Whistleblowers are made, they're not born. So that when you're in a system and you're trying to do the right thing, you're just trying to do your job, and you literally trip upon an issue like I did with the vanadium workers, and you just casually tell a supervisor, you know what, there's something that's not right about these figures, or there's something that's just not right about whatever it is. And then all of a sudden the system understands exactly what you said, even though perhaps you don't understand what you've discovered. And before you know it, the playbook, what I talk about in my book, No Fear, the playbook goes into action. So all of a sudden, an employee who's done quite well and is maybe even a very valued employee starts receiving negative comments in their personnel file. Their performance ratings start to dive north, and you're trying to figure out, what did I do wrong? But, you know, most people realize, okay, well, you know, I told the supervisor this, and I've been told to sort of clam up on it. And before you know, the system has moved fairly quickly to eliminate you. Because I'm still in litigation against the EPA.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm still in litigation because the EPA, because I was fired. Even though I won my case and I passed a major law, I was fired. And so I'm actually going back into the courtroom now, again, the second time, against the Lisa Jackson administration to prove that the EPA fired me because I spoke out against vanadium poisoning.
It's still never over.
It's never over. It's never over.
Tell us about the battle to get the No Fear Act passed and what it does.
Yeah, the No Fear Act was the first civil rights and whistleblower law of the 21st century. It was an enormous battle to get the law passed. I was very fortunate and blessed to win my law case in 2000. It was amazing because once I won my case, the system just sort of erupted because individuals are never supposed to be able to win against a government. And so only 2% of us win. And so it was considered quite newsworthy when I won. Congress invited me to testify. After I testified before Congress, a bill was introduced, interestingly enough, by a very conservative member of Congress, F. James Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, and a very liberal member of Congress, Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas. And it took 2 years, and we organized a group called the No Fear Coalition, and it was composed of the bravest and most noble people, some of the most noble people inside of the federal government. We lost people. There were people who actually died from stress and literally the stress of fighting for the bill, because once the government found out that they were a member of the group, their jobs were placed at risk. And for some people, for all people, I think that's an enormous burden to carry, particularly if you're a single-family head of household. But people were fired. We lost 2 people in the struggle. We demonstrated. We faxed. We did all the things that you're supposed to do to pass the law. And we were extremely fortunate to have people step forward and to support us. And after 2 very, very, very long, difficult years, we passed the law. One interesting part about passing this law is that I was obviously invited to the White House, and it was one of the most conservative presidents of this country signed it. United States government signed it. George W. Bush signed the first civil rights law. Interestingly enough, he doesn't even mention it in his autobiography that he signed the first civil rights law. So he obviously wasn't very, I don't know, I don't want to prejudge what he was thinking, but I was standing behind the president when he signed the law. As he was signing the law, all I could remember were all the people who I had met along that journey who had not made it to see the signing of this civil rights law. And I started to cry. Literally, as he was signing the bill. And he stood up and he sort of took me in his arms. And I was saying to him, you know, so many people didn't make it to see this day. And then just realized that he hadn't finished signing and said, you know, I can cry later. Why don't you finish signing the law? So what does the law do? The law protects whistleblowers inside the federal government by arming them with education and arming them with the knowledge so that they know how to protect themselves. So now in the United States, every federal government worker must take No Fear training every 2 years. If you join the federal government, you must be trained in your rights, in your civil rights, under law, within 90 days of joining the federal government. When I joined the federal government, I was trying to understand why no one seemed to care that they were about to lose a lot of money, because it was clear that I was going to win. It was what was happening to me was so outrageous. I mean, I was receiving death threats, rape threats. I was being called all kinds of racial epithets in the office. I was receiving threatening calls on my phone. I mean, I think everyone assumed, outside of an act of God, I was going to win this. And yet the federal government didn't seem to, the EPA, I should say, didn't seem to care. And one of the reasons why we found out that EPA didn't care was because they were not going to pay the bill. The guys in the White House or whatever had set up a little slush fund in case people like the 2% of us who won. So the bill was literally sent to a slush fund at the Department of Treasury. So EPA had no stakes in whether I won or not, financial stakes. So what the no-fear law says now is that if an agency loses a discrimination whistleblower case, that agency pays for it out of their budget. And then the agency has to go to Congress and explain to the American people why their budget has been cut by $1 million or whatever the amount of money that they've lost, because they've decided to protect discriminating managers. On every single federal government website, whether it's the White House or the FBI or the CIA, there is a no-fear icon that's posted on that front page. And when you click on the icon, all the data comes up for that agency in terms of how many people have filed discrimination complaints and what that status is. I mean, the law is quite extensive. And then on top of that, every 6 months, the president receives a no-fear file in which gives him a status picture of what's happening inside the federal government, as well as every single congressional office. So that's a nutshell of what no-fear does. And we're also, we've introduced no-fear 2 that provides congressional protection for people who contact their congressional member after blowing the whistle in the federal government. So that's a nutshell of what the law does.
And that is a huge accomplishment. We are running out of time. Is there a message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
The book has been optioned, I should say, for a movie by actor Danny Glover. And we're looking for people to work with us on the movie. Actually, this is a movie that's a bit different because we consider this movie a part of the activism. And so we're actually enlisting the help of the public to make the movie. My website is www.MarshaAdebayo.com, and you can buy my book on Amazon.com.
Right, so read her powerful story in the book, No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA, and watch for that new film coming out, The Marsha Coleman Adebayo Story, from award-winning actor and producer Danny Glover. And our Washington area listeners can hear Marsha in person at the Writers' Center Sunday, February 19th at 2 p.m. Check out www.writer.org for details. Marsha, thank you so much for your time and for your dedication.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Find out more about this program in our blog at ecoshock.info. Subscribe to our free podcast at the website, ecoshock.org. Next week, we'll talk about the emergency in the Arctic with some of the world's best climate scientists. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening.